Hello and welcome to another edition of Eight More Miles, the Louisville Metro Council District 8 podcast. This is Councilman Brandon Cohn. We are podcasting on Thursday, July the 20th, and our guest for the show is Philip Bailey from the Courier-Journal. Philip, thanks for being our guest.
Councilman, how you doing?
Doing really well, and appreciate you being on the show. I think this will be interesting.
Yeah, I say no to 99% of things people invite me to, so... Well, I don't know if you, that doesn't mean you should feel honored or anything.
No, we'll take it as a compliment.
I usually say I don't like to do things like this usually.
I understand. Well, hopefully you'll have such a great time you'll want to come back over and over again. For people who don't know you, tell us a little bit about what you do. And I know you're a reporter for the Courier-Journal, but there seem to be many different reporters who cover this sort of broad area of politics, government, law, state, local. And is there a certain way that people should be understanding, you know, your stories versus the stories that, you know, maybe your late colleague Martha Elson wrote, or that Andy Wolfson, my neighbor, wrote, or Sheldon Schaefer wrote? So what's sort of the difference between your beats?
Well, I cover Metro government. So that's your folks, the Metro Council, the mayor's office, city agencies. Martha, as you said, who died recently, she was a neighborhoods reporter. So I would say the big difference between those two would be, you know, the neighborhood associations, which sort of are the lifeblood of your district, she would probably be more intimately involved in some of their stories or their issues, whether that is issues of neighborhood maintenance. But then other issues, like, for example, crime, public safety, would be something like Matt Glowicki or a breaking news reporter, or maybe Beth Warner, some others would cover. So I get why people, when they read the stories, they often ask that question, because they'll come to me with a story that I'm like, I have nothing to do with that whatsoever. But yeah, my official title would be Metro Government Reporter, but I don't think most people, most readers care about those distinctions or titles. It just means that I'm the one who pays attention to what Metro government, city government is doing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the main purposes of this podcast is to try to help citizens understand government and the things that are tangential to government better, just so that they can really, you know, be empowered. And I think that it could be helpful to understand sort of the framework for where you're coming from when you're writing your stories versus some of the other reporters, and that's why I ask. So, as the Metro Government reporter, that means you cover the mayor's office, the Metro Council, the county attorney's office, all the departments, everything, or...
As much as we can.
Right, because you don't have a huge staff.
Yeah, I mean, as much as we can possibly do that is newsworthy and is pertinent, which gets into news judgment, news values, etc. So, no, I mean, I would say that, yeah, you're correct in that aspect. Those are sort of the broad ideas or the broad areas that I do cover. Not all of those things are necessarily covered equally, depending on what they're doing. For example, the county attorney's office, a lot of the stuff that they do is involving the courts. So that's something that Matt or Andy would cover. I usually would get involved with the county attorney's office when it deals something with the council or defending a lawsuit against the city, something of that nature. So it isn't just like generally following everything they do every single day, no.
Right. You tend to focus mostly on the actions of the mayor and the Metro Council.
Yes, yeah. I would say that's accurate.
And, you know, I find myself comparing the mayor's office and the Metro Council against each other a lot because, you know...
You've been in both.
I have been in both. Yeah. And they're supposed to be sort of co-equal branches of government. But I think in practice, that's not really true here at the local level where we have a strong mayor. You know, at the federal level, Congress and the President of the United States really have a balancing power on each other, or you might say. And even at the state level, between the governor and the General Assembly, here we sort of have a mayor's-driven administration.
Well, you're all part-time, right? I mean, that's part of it is that I would say in the most recent years, definitely early on, when merger first happened, Jerry Abramson, sort of this larger-than-life figure, council members, a lot of them were first-time in public office, trying to get their footing. And you really began to see, especially with the Cordish deals going on, the council take a more assertive role, right? Like the transparency laws, things of that nature. But you all are part-time. So, I mean, there are some of your members who are teachers. So they are out of the pocket for a good portion of the day when people like me are trying to get comment from them. They're in class. Councilman Peden's an example of that. Councilman Kramer, I believe Councilman Blackwell. I think, you know, one reason people always would ask me, why is Kelly Downer quoted so much in these stories? Kelly's retired, right? I mean, he was at City Hall every day, all the time. So when you have a part-time council and a full-time mayor, there's also other advantages the mayor's office has. The mayor is not a walking public meeting. Right, I mean, the mayor could be meeting with someone right now, and we have no idea who he's meeting with or talking to. Although that could be a point of contention sometime soon. but you all gather together, it's a public meeting, it's open, right? Like, so there are some distinct advantages in our system. But I would say that the council has been more assertive with this mayor's office, whether with Mayor Fisher or Mayor Abramson, more in recent years than initially thought of. Certainly much stronger than the old Board of Aldermen was with the mayor and the old system.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm sort of, I'm hearing you sort of saying that the Metro Council is evolving, and, yeah. and I see that, and I think it's really important because I think it's important for us to have a strong mayor and a strong council. Mm-hmm. And specifically with regards to communications, public information, media relations, mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you think the mayor's office does a good job of being accessible to the media and making public information really helpful and useful to people. And, you know, I'll just say, as opposed to, you know, some administrations tend to, you know, put forth the message that they want when they want, and that's how they practice the relations. I'm not saying that's my assessment of this mayor's office. I'm sort of asking you. Mm-hmm. And then I want you to sort of compare that against the council, because it seems to me that the mayor has a greater ability with the staff and with what they do to control message. He can call a press conference and you guys come and you listen. And I'm wondering whether the same thing would happen unless the council is really going to address something very important. Do we have sort of an equal ability to get your ear and to have our message told in the paper?
I think that you hit on something that's interesting. I think that not all council members are created equally. There are some members who are media averse, maybe because they've been burnt in the past or they felt like they've been treated unfairly. And some of them just, quite honestly, aren't good at it. They're not good at interviewing. They're not good at the back and forth. And some members are better at that, right? Comparing it to the mayor's office is really almost night and day because, look, when it comes to the mayor's office, their communication staff has a very structured approach.
They have speech writers.
They have speech writers. Like I said, he's not a walking public meeting. Despite the fact that this administration could do a far better job at being open with the media, he's the mayor. So when he speaks, it's sort of like he's speaking for the city. He's the mayor, right? But with the council member, if one council member has an opinion, well, you need 13 other members to agree with you for your opinion or your idea to make it through. So, for example, when Councilwoman Leet stepped out there and said she was, Councilwoman Angela Leet, when she said she was against and wanted Chief Conrad to resign, well, she's one member. Good for her. But she needs other people to sort of give her that credibility.
And I've made that same point to people so that they understand that as council people, we can be advocates for things, but individually, I have no power. The council as a body has power. Yeah. Individually, I don't.
And I think the one person who sort of struck that was the late Jim King, right? Like he was someone who was seen as, particularly in the early days of Mayor Fisher's reign in 2011 with the Louisville Orchestra, there was a lot of this contest of, well, who's the real mayor here? Who's the, so are they being co-mayor? Because, you know, Jim King had been in government for so long, so I knew what he was doing. And this was Fisher's first year. I remember that was a lot of back and forth conversation at that time. So yeah, I think that, you know, some of your members are better at it than others. Some members know how to sort of get this, you know, their opinions out, and they're willing to be more forthright. You know, you talk to some of these council members and they're like hedging their conversations or hedging their comments going, well, and it's kind of like, well, you don't even seem sure about your viewpoint, council member, not me. But I always think that you all could be more transparent.
And I guess my effort, I guess my question is really how we can be more effective because, you know, if people read a quote from me mm-hmm. in a story that you've written in the last mm-hmm. 6 months, it's usually because you call me.
Yeah.
And you can disagree, but I try to answer your phone calls.
You're one of the better ones.
Most of the time.
You're one of the better ones, yeah.
But what I'm interested in, and I guess it's a question if I'm asking if the mayor's office does a good job, if the council does a good job, and particularly how can I do a better job? I try to communicate with my people all the time, and mm-hmm. I've tried to do new ways of doing that that mm-hmm, my predecessor mm-hmm. certainly didn't, that a lot of council people don't do. The podcast, social media,
yeah.
an e-newsletter. And there are certain things that I would love to be able to communicate to the 30,000 people in my area. I want everybody to sign up to get junk alerts and street sweeping alerts,
aww.
Basic stuff like that. You know, but it's really important because, you know, it's simple stuff, but it doesn't work if only 10% of people on the street do it.
Yeah.
And so I ask people to do it all over my website, in my e-newsletter, every time I go anywhere. But if the Courier Journal wrote one story about it, I'd have more people sign up than all my efforts in 6 months or a year.
Right.
And so I know that if I call a press conference to ask people to sign up for street sweeping, you guys probably aren't coming.
Yeah, I can tell you right now.
So, but is there some other way that my colleagues and I can be working with the media? And I know it's not your job to amplify mm-hmm. our message, but to sort of, you know, get out information to people other than just sort of a standard press release and see who comes and listens?
Well, I think, number one, it's a question of, is this a constituent service that is mainly your office's responsibility, or is it a community concern of larger implication? Because that gets into the question of newsworthy, a news judgment, or news value. Mm-hmm. I often find that what council members think, not just council members, but what city officials think of as, quote, newsworthy is really more of a bulletin. I want people to know this. Cool. I have no objection to that whatsoever. The question for often, I think, particularly in this day and age now, news corporations or news entities are focusing more of their attention on what gets the most hits or what gets the most attention. There has been, I think, this cutoff of the bottom half of a lot of this news that was sort of seen as, oh, well, this is what the newspapers or this is what news organizations do. They put these bulletins in. And not so much anymore. And I don't know if social media has taken the place of that, because I was just having a conversation with editors before this, and I was saying, you know, I don't think that social media platforms were created for news organizations to deliver our content to folks. They were created for, if we remember, for college kids to screw around. I mean, that was the point. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I remember being on the original Facebook, like when it was the Facebook.
Yeah, me too.
It was not for anyone else but people who had a college email address. And it's evolved into that, but I don't know if it's the best delivery system for sort of important news. So I would say, number one, you as a public official have to think to yourself, why is this important? I know you might think it's important, but why is it important to the community at large or to my constituents, even in my district? Basically, what I'm saying to you, Councilman, is that you have to get a better pitch together. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I think oftentimes people in government don't have a good pitch. They just assume that, well, I think this is important and you all should do it. Well, good for you. But that doesn't mean it is. You have to come up with a better rationale of why it is. It's something that we should spend our resources and time doing to inform the public. I think that's a conversation, quite honestly, we often don't have with one another because we're always sort of stiff with one another in our workspaces.
You don't mean you and me. You mean...
No, not you and I. You and I got a good okay. What was the dudes from Miami Vice?
Rapport?
Tubbs and Crockett. We got like little Tubbs and Crockett, Mel Gibson, Danny Glover thing going here. But there are a lot of your...
I'm not a Mel Gibson fan for a lot of reasons.
You're not a Mel Gibson? Oh, yeah, I'm talking about pre-anti-Semitic, pre-racist Mel Gibson. 1980s Mel Gibson.
Okay. Maybe.
Maybe, okay. Maybe I'll find a better white-black dynamic duo for you to jump onto. But anyway, that's why it's a podcast, man. It's supposed to go off on strays like this. It's supposed to be so stiff. The question is, you were asking was, people often are, I know my reputation precedes me. So people will have conversations with me about the most non-newsworthy thing. And they'll say, well, off the record, Philip. I'm like, off the record? Like, do you think what you're about to say is important like that? Like, who do you think you are? Like, you think you're like the CIA?
You want to explain just for people?
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, that's obviously one of those sort of funny things when you tell somebody, hey, off the record, and then you drop some bombshell, you know, as if there's some...
I advise not to do that because that doesn't count.
Can you explain to listeners how if me or another public official is talking to you and they say that, what that means and how that really works in your industry?
Number one, I would tell folks, I usually am a bit nicer to non-public officials. We're like a regular folk, people who I don't interview that often, regular random residents, whether they're controversial or not. Before you say, ask me, because I have to agree to it first. You can't say, Philip, I want to tell you this, and say, off the record, and you say it, and then like, I'm not supposed to do anything with
right.
it. That's not how it works.
Right.
You have to ask me that, and if I grant you permission, because I don't grant off the record to just anyone.
What might be some legitimate reason why people would say, hey, let me tell you something off the record or on background? Tell me, what are some reasons why they
might
do
that? Well, number one,
that?
Reprisal. I mean, we have a whistleblower's law for a reason. There are people, particularly in government, whether it's local government, state government, or at the federal level, who say things and they are afraid of being fired or harassed or some sort of backlash against them. And what we, I think, have learned in this administration, at least at the federal level, is that I think we all can at least accept that whatever you think of the news has been a check and balance on President Trump. There are certain things the American people know today that they wouldn't know without the New York Times, the Washington Post, etc. Mm-hmm. And journalism is a calling. I mean, like, you certainly ain't doing it for the money.
Well, let's. I know we're jumping around a little bit, but let me ask you about that, because, you know, there's not too much available about sort of your biography online. You don't have a nice prepackaged like you know a public some other.
Are you about to ask you some personal questions?
Well, we looked at your LinkedIn account at least to sort of see where you come from, what you do.
Who checks
you know, and I've I've read you and listened to you long enough to have heard you on WFPL, to have read you in Leo, to have read you in Louisville Magazine. You've really done a tour of Louisville media organizations.
I don't know if that's a good or bad
thing.
Well,
no, I think that's a great thing. But I guess my question is, where did this sort of interest in journalism and writing come from? I see that you're a poli-sci, studied poli-sci at the University of Louisville. Yeah. So have you just always been interested in reading and writing, or where did that come from?
I can remember, and Jasmine, you're legislative aide, who I knew in college, might remember this. My first of all, I wrote for my high school newspaper, Central High School, CHS, Baddest Land from East to West. I wrote for that school newspaper, but that wasn't that good. I remember going to college. Initially, I was going to write op-eds for the Louisville Cardinal, but some other guys had already started this African-American newspaper called The Solution, which was a really radical newspaper. I mean, we used to put, like, quotes from, like, Ice Cube and Trick Daddy. I mean, it was hard. I mean, it was like, oh, man, it was rough. And it was, not I would say somewhat, it was controversial. And I was writing op-eds for them at the time. So initially, that was my introduction to, quote-unquote, journalism. I didn't really initially think I was going to be a journalist. I actually wanted to be a college professor, weirdly enough.
Me too.
And then before that, I actually wanted to be an FBI agent. So yeah, so that was sort of my introduction to journalism through that way. And then, of course, you know, writing for the Cardinal officially through its op-eds, and then I did some initial stuff with, like, the Courier, which is sort of trying to find its footing online with some of its youth blog stuff via Betty Baye and Keith Runyon, who used to be on the editorial board way back when, back in the Bush era. It's screwed up that I measure time by who's president. You can tell I'm an old poli-sci person. So yeah, that was my first sort of introduction to it. But I do believe it is. It has to be a calling, because journalism is the one place where little people who are in power, get to check and poke people who are in power. They get to literally ask them inconvenient questions. And that's the difficult part, I think, initially for people to understand. That's why it's so easy to blame the media, because our job is to get in your business.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my job is to ask you, what are you doing, and why are you doing it?
Right.
And we are taught by our very nature to be polite to one another. You don't ask those sorts of questions. You know. And I think a part of journalism is to be, quote unquote, rude in that way.
And so did you choose poli-sci because U of L doesn't have a journalism program?
No. I was a poli-sci Pan-African Studies major, and I mean, I just love politics.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my sort of entry into that. That had nothing sort of to do one way or the other. It wasn't my thought of wanting to go to J school or something like that. No, that wasn't my thought process at all.
Yeah, and I've mentioned to a couple of people, I've never taken one political science class in my life, and I'm not sure. Am I missing something, do you think, that I'd be better at my job having studied?
No,
I was in an English major and an American history minor, and went to law school, obviously.
No, I don't think, I mean, Chuck Todd made a point about, you know, I don't think you need to study political science to cover politics, for example. I don't think that's a prerequisite at all, no.
Well, let me go back to social media,
because
you mentioned that, and a lot of different social media platforms. People are obviously familiar with a handful that are dominant: Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc.
Snapchat. You on Snapchat?
Do not know anything about Snapchat. I thought about it during the campaign, and I just didn't think it was worth my time.
I'm on Snapchat, but I really don't get what it's used for. Other than the reason I think there's only two types of people I think use Snapchat: kids and like sexual predators. Like, there's only two people I think would want to use a device in which you can send someone a message or picture that would be erased within 2 seconds of you sending it.
Yeah, I mean, I literally know nothing about it. But I find that I don't really like Instagram that much, because when I'm using social media, I like news. I want information. I'm just kind of a person that's trying to learn something.
You can learn from Instagram if you follow the right one, though.
Okay. Well, you're very active on Twitter, right? Would you agree that that is your social medium of choice?
For good or ill, yes, I would say. People often come up to me and say, I follow you on Twitter, and I often have to apologize.
But so do you not use Facebook and Instagram, or you use all those things?
Oh, I use all of those. I mean, it's just, you know, I read some article about Facebook is the suburbs and Twitter is the streets. And, you know, if you think about it, I mean, Facebook is a sort of more closed off community. It's sort of this like white suburb. Like, you're very restricted in what you can do, where you can go. I can't just randomly follow you. You have to accept me as your friend to be on there. Whereas in Twitter, I can just follow you if I want to. They're two different platforms altogether. So no, I'm on Facebook. I'm just very selective about who I have followed beyond Facebook.
Right.
I have like maybe 200 friends on Facebook.
But you use, and my Facebook is sort of you know, at one point was something that I used personally for friends and family.
It's probably a mix of your personal and political life.
Now I get thousands of just people, and you know, it's a good for me to put a message there because I try to put messages everywhere.
Yeah.
But for Twitter, you sort of use it to break news. Like, you sort of use it in your professional capacity and also in your individual capacity. You tweet about sports or whatever else is on your
comic
mind.
Books.
Is there?
Yeah. I tell people, if you follow me, you're following me. And if you don't like what I say or tweet, then stop following me. I have no problem whatsoever telling people that, whether in person or on social media. I mean, it's my personal Twitter account. But obviously, I'm a reporter. I'm putting my work on there for you to consume. But yeah, if I go on a rant about Batman or Black Panther, I post up something about, you know, recently I found out, like, man, these stories about R. Kelly and Usher. I think I put up how, because, you know, R. Kelly and Usher did, for your audience, please tell me knows who R.
Yes.
Kelly and Usher. Okay, good. Years ago, man, they did a song called Same Girl. My friend was like a big time Usher fan. And now looking back at that story, I mean, looking back at that video, I think I tweeted out recently, like, this R. Kelly Usher video is like a horror movie. Because now R. Kelly's accused of keeping women in dungeons and locking them up and telling them what they can eat. And of course, Usher got accused in a lawsuit of giving a woman herpes. So, yeah, revelation there. Sorry about that, Usher. I just will randomly, and I will literally put the hashtag random on it. If you don't like that, unfollow me.
Well, so let me ask you this. Do you find Twitter to be a particularly good, because I'm no social media expert at all. I haven't figured out the best way to use any of the different media. But is Twitter particularly good for news one way or the other? Or for me, I sort of tend to use it as just, here's a link to something.
Yeah.
And I hope a lot of people see
it. Well, personally, I hate social media now. If I wasn't a journalist, I would not be on social media. Everyone on Twitter, and this is a matter of they're liberal or conservative, is a crybaby. Who gets on my absolute last nerve with all this triggering nonsense and everything else they complain about. But no, I think it's different. I think Facebook is certainly, you see news organizations will tell you that algorithms and all that are better for news content on Facebook. But certainly, I mean, Twitter is a vehicle for delivering news in some sort of way to people. I mean, I think news organizations are in a struggle right now to figure out, how do we get people to pay attention to our content?
Mm-hmm. Well, right? What do you think? You were on the radio.
Uh-huh.
What do you think about podcast? I think that this is the first Metro Council office to have a podcast.
You got to loosen up more, though, man. You're kind of stiff, man. You got to loosen up. See, I told you about Joe Budden's podcast. You need to listen to Drink Champs with Nori. See, I listen to, like, old has-been rappers who are really very in-depth about their art and some of the more interesting parts of the genre. But no, I think that podcasts are cool. I just think they have to be, they're the opposite of these sort of well-produced shows.
But I mean, to me, I don't really see a difference between a podcast and the news and notes program used to do on WFPL. I mean, you know, it was a serious
program. There's some similarities. Yeah.
But, I mean, people are listening to us, whether it's live broadcast or not. Do you find that this is a good way to get information across to people, because if they're listening, they're relaxing, they're not doing something else, and maybe people don't want to read 2,000 words, but they'll listen for 10 minutes?
No, that was always the advantage. I mean, whether public radio or commercial radio, is that radio, you don't have to be directly involved with it to consume it. With a newspaper or any sort of news content online, you have to read it, right? Television, you have to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your kid could be knocking over the stove and burning themselves and burning down the entire house, right? But with radio, you can be, you know, cooking the food or chopping up your linguine or whatever people do when they listen to commercial or public radio. I have no idea. I remember Tyler Allen, who I think, is he still on the Louisville Public Media Board? He ran for mayor.
I think he is.
I hung out with Tyler, actually, when I was for Ricky Jones's birthday. Shout out to Ricky Jones. Dr. Ricky Jones, excuse me. So he was telling me about how, for him, listening to the radio is this thing where I can still do other things while I can still consume it. So, and it's a different, you know, it's audio. It's an audio consumption rather than a visual consumption. So I think it's always a medium where people can be more relaxed and listen to it.
Have you thought about translating any of your stories that you write for The Courier into an audio format?
We've talked about that. I mean, I know that certainly they think that I have a knack for that. I guess you have to have a little bit more of an outgoing personality. I'll tell you, and this is why I started off your show by saying I very rarely agree to do things. Louisville is a weak town, man. It's my hometown. But it's a place where, I mean, it's amazing to me the things that people complain about. Amazing the things that people try to get me fired over, or like, it'll be the most inconsequential of things. Like, if anyone's followed me, they would know that, like, I'm a rabid UofL fan, and I talk mad trash to UK fans, like, slick, this mean, trashy talk to people on social media.
It's about, off-season, though.
About UK. And I remember when I was, I think I was still at FPL at the time, and someone had sent my editor a note asking me to be, like, reprimanded for comments I was making about UK. The most recent thing I had was, and most people probably heard this, was when Councilman Johnson's attorney had made some sort of comment about, he was surprised to see me with my clothes on and without a gun. And the reason was because there was this picture of me in my house imitating Hunter S. Thompson. It was just interesting, like the things that people pick on in Louisville about these sorts of things. So I don't know. I mean, I'm interested in how Louisville's sort of growing up and becoming this more expansive city and open-minded. But to me, it's very much the city where there are a number of folks who, like, they get upset about the smallest and pettiest of things.
Well, you basically segued for me because, you know, really, Hunter S. Thompson, a child of the Highlands neighborhood.
Yes, yeah.
Really was...
Isn't it kind of funny that Louisville has given birth to the two biggest rebels of the 20th century?
Yeah.
Muhammad Ali and Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah, and so yeah. I wanted to ask
you... No wonder they didn't stay in town that long.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. In a lot of ways, it seems like the media culture that we're in right now, where you just sort of mentioned yourself that, you know, you're I don't, not a character, you're a role player in
a
the
character.
News.
You're
a role player in a news story recently, whether you chose to be or not. You brought into it, whereas in the past, you know, the news was written and it was framed by some person, it doesn't matter who, on the byline. And Hunter S. Thompson, I guess, maybe broke the mold by injecting himself into the story
and
writing from
So
do you take inspiration from his work? Do you like his work? Do
I love
think
his work.
We're in sort of a... And is social media and everything that's going on now kind of an evolution from
Hunter's... is the dual of that. I think people often ask me, what do you think about this? Or I tell people, it doesn't matter what I think. I should be the least important person, actually, to you. I think that what's gotten a lot of journalists in trouble is that they want to be the stars of the show sometimes. I mean, that's what got Brian Williams in trouble, right? I mean, Brian Williams actually, former NBC, NBC Nightly News, just in case people don't know.
I'm an NBC Nightly News guy myself.
Yeah, I was. And I used to love Brian Williams on NBC Nightly News. But, you know, Brian Williams actually thought, I read somewhere, he wanted to be the host of The Tonight Show. Now, let me get this straight. You are the anchor for probably, at least my view, one of the premier sort of broadcast nightly news programs, and you want to be the host of The Tonight Show. You want to be like Jimmy Fallon or Jay Leno. That's just peculiar to me. That's an odd segue from one career to the next. And I think, you know, too many journalists do want to be sort of the stars of the news, which I think sort of undermines the news. But with social media, it only works when you're yourself. Mm-hmm. And there's this tug of war because a lot of journalists have been reprimanded, fired, or at the very least scolded for, you know, being too much of themselves on social media because it's like, you know, this perception of your bias or, you know, you could be seen a certain way. And it's put a lot of them off about why they don't use it other than just to simply post their links, which is why people don't really care about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said earlier, you're following me. And I think the reason why people know who I am via social media is because I'm myself. I'm not just posting up links to the story and say, please read this. Like, I'm myself. Mm-hmm. You're getting a version of me, at least, or a particular time frame that I happen to be tweeting, which has been sometimes good and sometimes bad. I mean, I've been talked to a bunch of times by employers about that. Most of the time, I've shrugged my shoulders at it and said, "What come what may." But it is. It can be, a struggle, particularly for local journalists who are much more susceptible to being reprimanded for things like that. There are some national journalists like Dave White, who I know, a writer for the Washington Post, reporter there. Every time he comes in town, we hang out. And he's much more free, at least on the outside looking in. But I asked him about that, and he said, there's only been a few times Marty Baron, who's the editor of the Washington Post, people should know, was the head of the Boston Globe when it did those stories about the Catholic Church, which I believe was a movie recently that was quite good. Mm-hmm. You know, he says, you know, I've been reprimanded about him or talking about him a few times, but nothing, you know, that's gotten me fired. So I do. I think that there's a tug of war on that. I just generally have shrugged my shoulders at it. I'm going to be myself no matter what, I guess.
Well, I don't know too much about the profession of being a writer or a journalist, but it seems like, you know, there are a lot of different kinds of jobs out there. You can be on radio, TV, and the newspaper. You could write for a magazine. I read that you went to an academy for alternative journalism in Chicago while you were in school. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's different kinds of publications you can write for. There's different places you can work.
And you did like the whole homework. Did you talk to like an ex-girlfriend?
I looked at your LinkedIn page. That's basically.
Oh, okay. You just looked at the LinkedIn page. Yeah.
So, you know, you're here still in Louisville where you're from. I'm here in Louisville where I'm from. We're about the same age.
How old are you?
I'm 36.
Okay, you're only about 3 years older. Good.
So are you in Louisville because you're particularly interested in it? And I mean, this is obviously...
Uh-huh.
I mean, you could go work for the Chicago Tribune if you loved your experience there and you want city life, or you want to go work for the Washington Post or the Boston Globe. Are you here because you want to be here and you love this place? Because people that are our age, in our early 30s, mid-30s, the time of life when you go. Maybe you come back, maybe you don't.
Yeah.
You want to sort of shed some light on that for people? Or?
For me, it's a bit of a personal reason. I own a house in Louisville. I own the house that my grandparents bought back in 1963. I'm anchored sort of by that home. It's the house my mother grew up in. It's the house that I inherited from her. So there's sort of a personal connection to it. I have no problem with leaving Louisville necessarily. I've often told people this is probably my last go-round with local journalism if there is a, you know, a life cycle to it. You know, I don't know. I don't know if many people my age who see themselves as journalists for their entire life, like some folks who still work at the Courier and who work at other places do. Like, it was something that they see themselves doing for their entire life. I see myself being a journalist. I don't know if I'll always be in the same place. Right, it is a job you can sort of move around and do other places. So I've never been adverse to living outside of Louisville. It's just been the question of, is this the right opportunity for me at the right time, and do I want to do that?
But you obviously care about this place, or you wouldn't be here.
Oh, yeah. No, there's no doubt. I mean, Louisville to me is, I mean, I have a love-hate relationship with Louisville, particularly West Louisville, where I live. Never lived below 40th Street, baby, by the way. I always make people know that. Like, my street cred is impeccable.
You mean east of 40th Street?
No, no, I've never lived below 40th. I've always lived 40th or further west. Never 39th, no 38th, nah, baby. End of the West End, by the river. So, I have this sort of love-hate relationship with it because I've seen Louisville progress, and I think it's just now sort of on that cusp of becoming a real city with, like, a diverse population and ideas, and people sort of open to different ideas, and people are more mobile. But Louisville still is a top-heavy city. And I hear this from white folks.
I agree with you 100%.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know. I mean, you've said that. Talked about it before. I mean, there are it's a certain sort of top-heaviness to the city of certain blue bloods, Binghams, Browns, etc., who you have to know to get things done. That's what I've often heard from my white counterparts and white peers. And on the other side of that, I mean, when you add racial diversity to it, oh, my God. I mean, you're really talking about a lily white town in which I think a lot of particularly middle-class African-Americans often go, now, do I want to go to a place that's like lily white? They probably don't want me here. Or do I have to go to a place like that's a hole in the wall? Why am I getting murdered? Like, there's this weird sort of choice that people are sort of faced with. I think the lack of a black middle class to me is the future of Louisville, right? I mean, that's the whole question of what's going to happen with Russell. The mayor often talks about the revitalization of Russell. I can tell you the conversation people in the community have around that is, what is that new Russell going to look like? I mean, we're here in gentrified Smoketown, which is completely not what it used to look like a few short years ago.
Well, I'm just going to interject. You know, I mean,
disagree any point you want to.
No. You know, gentrification obviously is a loaded word.
Yes.
And you know, I lived in New York City for a year.
What part of New York you
live
in?
Not long. I lived in Midtown. I lived at 35th between 3rd and Lex. But I worked for President Clinton in Harlem.
Oh, yeah.
And this was in 2004. Yeah. And I think Harlem was gentrifying at the time. And
yes.
I don't know what Harlem looks like today. But I guess my point is, gentrification in a city like New York, it happens fast.
Yeah.
Gentrification in a city like Louisville, it happens real slow. So I think I think on balance, it's a good thing for there to be outside investment, or whatever you want to call it, in some neighborhoods, Portland, Russell, Shelby Park, Smoketown. Obviously, policymakers' job should be to have some forethought and figure out, okay, well, how can we let this area rise up and still protect people that are there? And that's a serious challenge, but I think it's one that we can approach in a city this size where things move slower. And I don't think that there's been any sort of rapidly gentrifying. I don't think we need to worry about gentrification at this point. I think I even heard the mayor say, hey, when that's something we got to worry about, I'll be happy that's something
I think the people of Clarksdale and Shepherd Square would disagree.
Okay.
I mean, I think that there are gentrification for whom? Who will this ultimately benefit? I think it's the question that comes down to some of these radical changes to these neighborhoods. I remember when Gil Holland came in for an editorial board meeting with the Courier when he was running for council. And he had talked about, crime has gone down in that area. And I said, yeah, Gil, we got rid of Clarksdale. I mean, when you wipe out an entire population of people, the community changes overnight.
Right, and that is different than sort of what we're talking about, what I'm trying to talk about, gentrification. When you literally have a huge tens of millions or hundreds of million dollars project and you're moving mm-hmm. people out, that is different. I agree with you. That's a different situation. And I think that needs to be handled very delicately. Let me ask about the Highlands area, the Greater Highlands area, which I represent.
The land of the blessed, District 8. Some people call it.
So are you, as the Metro government reporter, I mean, you know the lines, you know where District 8 is versus District 7 uh-huh. and 6 and so on and so forth. So District 8, we'll just call it the Greater Highlands area. I'm wondering about your impressions of it as a citizen and as a journalist. Mm-hmm. You know, what issues are important, what you think in terms of it being an integrated or segregated part of town. Just mm-hmm. sort of your overall impressions of the Highlands area. Do you spend time here? Did you ever live here?
No, I never lived in the Highlands. I had friends who obviously lived there. And hung out in college. I mean, I always tell people who come from the outside, the Highlands is sort of the hip place of Louisville, right? It's a pedestrian, it's clearly was built to be pedestrian friendly. And that gives it an advantage that I think is always why other parts of Louisville, particularly other neighborhoods, should never try to compare themselves to the Highlands or compete with the Highlands, because the Highlands has a fundamental advantage in the way it was structurally built.
Well, West Louisville has great infrastructure.
Oh, yeah, no, but it's, I wouldn't say West Louisville's neighborhoods are both commercial and pedestrian friendly. Like, Broadway is not a cool place to be crossing in the middle of the street.
Right.
Like, that was meant for cars, and if you're black... if you want to cross the street and take that risk of getting hit, be my guest.
Go to the crosswalk.
But I've seen people get rolled over on Broadway.
I
wouldn't advise doing it. But in the Highlands, certain parts of it, it's certainly more pedestrian friendly. And I think that informs its behavior, its ability to sort of accept certain things, like certain parts of the culture. It's considered a real sort of hip liberal part of town. Although this might not be true anymore. I believe the 2010 census actually showed that District 16, all the way out in the west, out in the east, was more diverse, racially diverse than the Highlands. That might be true anymore.
I can't believe that.
I remember seeing those stats, but I need to pull them up. But that could be true. But no, I mean, I think it's always been seen to me as sort of the hip part of Louisville, where there's just sort of this commercial and residential shared space. From a demographic standpoint, I always see the black skater kids out in the Highlands. You know, like, it's always sort of like a place where I think people are sort of finding themselves, young and old. It's, you know, a lot of hippies sometimes can be found out in the Highlands. But no, to me, it's always been a place where the Highlands, certain things are just acceptable in your district that aren't acceptable in other
It
places.
Seems to me like the diversity of people I see on a Saturday night at bars in the Highlands.
Oh, yeah.
Is it's popping people out come there, from all over the city.
But there's certain things you can do. You can be drunk in the Highlands, and the police will help you. you can be stoned. I've seen white girls get stoned, twisted, drunk. I mean, just literally white girl wasted on Barstown Road. And if you were drunk like that out in front of Legends on 26 and Broadway, you would be in jail, girl. Like, for real. So there's a certain culture that's accepted. I mean, even cruising. Like, they cruise on Baxter, that part of Baxter Avenue, Barstown Road, all the time. This mm-hmm. is when they were cracking down on cruising out in the West End. And so it was interesting to me when these stories were popping up about Cahoots. Because Cahoots was sort of this place where I knew a lot of, like, people were going to. And it was seen as sort of this interracial enclave, and obviously it had different issues and allegations of criminal activity, drug paraphernalia, etc. But it was interesting, the perception of that place, how it was viewed sort of as an island in the Highlands by some. But no, man, like, the one thing I love about the Highlands is that you can go down there and you can see, like, oh, this is how a city can be. It can be sort of this mm-hmm. open-minded place with different people and, you know, LGBT folks free and openly holding hands. I mean, it's certainly a part of Louisville that, like, we dream of it to be that way.
Well,
some people do.
I'll say one thing, and you know, I obviously love this area,
uh-huh.
and in talking to people when I campaign or when I'm out and about, the people in the Highlands care about the whole city. They care about the city as a whole. They care about places.
Well, hell, I think we did. Man, I'm getting old. Can't remember all these things, but a certain number of the boards and commissions and people who volunteer from in city government come from the Highlands. And that's always been an issue of contention for folks, particularly out in Councilman Blackwell's district, South Louisville and West Louisville and other parts. But yeah, I mean, I think you can certainly say people in that community care about the city often as a whole.
Well, yeah, I mean, I just hear from people, you know, when I knocked on people's doors running for office, hey, what are you interested in? What needs to be fixed?
But also, you all are privileged, though, to be able to do that. When you have more fluency, more wealth, you have more time to volunteer. I joked with Andy Wilson, because I guess he signed some petition about you all having some issue with some tennis courts being closed. And I joked with him about, you know, these are some first world problems y'all having out here, right? Like, when your number one issue that's getting people, I joke with Andy, are we going to have a sit-in in the Highlands about these tennis courts?
Well, this is sort of where I'm going with it. Yeah. What I'm trying to say is, I know that people that live in the Highlands want to help other parts of town, and it's not, you know, us helping you kind of situation,
you're
but people are concerned. No, I know it's, but you know, it's, people are concerned about the city as a whole.
Yes.
When I talk to people and they want to know how they can participate. And I will say, I do think that I think the mayor's done a good job of trying to say to people, hey, look, we need everybody to help. Here is how you can help. And a lot of time there seems to be some disconnect between people saying we want to help and then people actually helping. But it seems like a lot of the time in the news, which is, you know, where you do your work, and in the public eye, a lot of the stories that sort of get elevated to front page status are, you know, a preservation battle or a development battle or, you know, how many parking spaces should this restaurant have? Sort of what I would consider one of the tennis courts issues you kind of mentioned. And, you know, those are real issues for people. People have property interests and concerns and want to know what's going to affect them next door to them and their business. But it seems to me almost like there's an imbalance there in the media coverage. And I'm wondering if you...
Just like positive news versus negative news?
Yeah, or just what really should...
I was gonna say, I don't believe in negative news.
Well, no, I guess I just really, you know, are some of the things that are written about here in the Highlands really newsworthy, like you talk about, in big picture? Or can they somehow be distracting from some of the larger issues that are really affecting the city?
Good question. I would say that if all the planes landed safely at Stanford Field, would you care about that? Right? I mean, news is about conflict. It's about disagreement. It's not negative. It's about, I mean, if someone is murdered on your block, do you want the first story of the nightly news to be about the bake sale? Right? I mean, you want to know, like, what happened to this person who I saw every day on my street who is no longer with us? What is this issue with this historic building that I find to be this beloved, great piece of our history, and this person's going to buy it and tear it down? So for every person who might say, well, this is really negative, and I don't know why it's always about the things we're not doing right, why isn't it more positive? I don't look at it that way. I look at it as what's interesting, what's informative to the community, and what do we need to look at a more critical eye with? Now, I do think that there's a space for that, more feature sort of stories, because people always complain about those sort of fluff pieces that we often do sometimes. People get just as upset about those. It's for the Highlands, once again, it's one of those things about accessibility. Because it's such an affluent space where a lot of reporters often have lived, where a lot of public officials have lived, your district has, I think, a distinct advantage because those folks are often just institutionally hooked up to those media institutions and government institutions.
When you say a distinct advantage in what?
Well, in the sense of being able to get its message out there quickly, right? I mean, it's as easy as I know this person, I can tell them what's going on, and I can articulate that to them in a way that's very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I'm interested in is, you know, what advice is there maybe for residents of District 8 to be smarter, more adept news consumers? If their interest is, I want to save that building, and I'll read the story about it, but I'm really interested in what's going on elsewhere, and this seems to be the flashing issue in my area right now. Is there some way that, you know, where do you get your news? What else should people be reading? What else should they be looking at? What else should they be doing?
Oh, yeah, I think citizens have a responsibility to improve their news diet. I mean, if someone from a foreign country comes to America and they eat Burger King, Pizza Hut, and McDonald's, and they write a book about American cuisine, I'm not taking that legitimately. Like, you ate at the worst places we have. So if you consume the easiest 24-hour news cycle media, I get it. Like, that's why you have this sort of negative perception about what's going on in the country or about the media in general. So I have no problem with people telling people, read what other folks are writing about, read what other people are saying or doing, because not all of us are doing the same thing. I mean, there is a distinct difference between, I think, the Courier's coverage and an Insider Louisville's or WFPL's or WHAS.
And what about... I didn't mean to
go ahead. Go ahead.
What about some of the, you know, you've got to write stories and turn them around really quick. It takes me forever to write my newsletter because I'm a very picky economical writer, and I just, you know, the writer's block, the whole thing. You have to pump those things out sometimes. Mm-hmm. Do you miss, or do you have the opportunity to take your time and write either an investigative piece or to write a really long, you know, 5,000 words about an in-depth subject where you can really explore the same stuff that you cover, but that you could do it in a way that you think that you would want to do because you think you could teach people more or inform them more, and you have that opportunity?
There's always a longer story that you're working on, at least I know I can speak for every reporter, that you're working on as the daily stuff is being churned out, the daily story, this daily development on this particular hot topic or whatever it might be. Sometimes those things don't always come to fruition. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you'll spend some time on a story and it runs into a dead end and it's not what you thought it was going to be and we have to drop it.
And this is more of an investigative kind of a piece?
Yeah. So people will say, well, what are you working on long term? And you have to put them almost in stages. There are the stories that I'm working on long term that are ready to get done, that just haven't been edited yet or whatever. There are stories that are still at fledgling stages. I can think of a number of those that I'm working on. And you know, this thing takes time. I mean, I would rather be right than be first. Mm-hmm. So there is a double check. There's a triple check on my part where I'm very, very methodical. I believe in doing 1, 2, 3 before I even think about 7, 8, 9. Mm-hmm. And I know people think, oh, this is very fast, you turn this around quickly, but part of it is when you do cover a beat, you cover city government as long as I have, you are sort of familiar with certain things and people. But there is this, you know, approach of, yeah, we want to be fast, we want to get things up quickly so we can get it to the best audience at the right time, but it's important that we are, especially nowadays, especially in this day and age, to be accurate and to be right about it. I hope that readers understand that and take that value. Even when we do make mistakes, we try to be honest about them and correct them as quickly as possible when they're honest mistakes in this business as much as possible.
Do you have any interest in politics? Could you imagine yourself working
as an elected official or
in government? You know, there's plenty of people who work in journalism and then turn around and...
go to the dark side, yeah.
But you know, I mean, clearly you must have some interest in this overall subject, being around it for so long or studying it.
I always have these sort of daydreams about how I might vote on something or think about something. I just can never imagine anyone in the area I live in wanting to vote for an agnostic African-American. I just couldn't imagine, imagine me running for office and getting up in front of a black church and saying, yeah, I don't believe any of this hocus pocus. I just couldn't imagine that ever.
You know me.
Maybe I should use the term hocus pocus, too, if I want to actually get their votes.
You know me though. I think I really believe in ideas, and I feel like I imagine you must have some ideas about. Here's some things that we would be doing differently if you were in charge or if you had a say about.
Oh yeah, no. I mean that certainly. I mean, I'm an American. I mean, I certainly have opinions about things and think about like how should this go political strategy, things of that nature, running campaigns or being in public office or advising or whatever, things like that. But I don't know. I do what I do because I believe that someone has to hold these folks accountable. I think that someone has to call them into question and be skeptical and be critical while informing the public about what they do.
Yeah.
And I get that that is a job that doesn't necessarily get you a lot of friends. I mean...
I'm glad you do it. I mean, I think it's really wonderful.
Say that now. Wait until like next week. No,
please, man. You know, seriously. You know, I mean, I'm a big believer in media myself.
I say this. I was talking to a friend of mine about this. I don't think we can really know what a public official is until they're tested by the media, right? Until there's a story about them that they hate and they dislike. You learn a lot about that public official from that. And we've learned a lot about the president via that. And there are some people who have that initial sort of like, I remember... funny story, Councilwoman Mary Woolridge, she wouldn't speak to me for an entire year. Like she did not speak to me for a whole year because I did a story. I think she had missed like about 4 months worth of meetings because she was ill. And constituents were calling and we did a story about that. We weren't trying to uncover what her illness was or anything, but she took it personal. She didn't like that. And I completely understand why she wouldn't have, because we're getting in her business, right? But as we explained to her spokesperson at the time, you know, there's a public accountability that we're doing here. This is a part of the job that she may not understand or like. And it's interesting because now she speaks to me. She does interviews with us all the time. But there often is that test of public officials where there's a story they don't like. How will they react to that? Will they try to completely shut you out? Will they not want to speak to you at all? Will they claim you're fake news?
I just want to be quoted accurately and in context. I think that's all I really ask.
Yeah, the Mayor of Bowling Green. Aren't you running for Mayor of Bowling Green? It reminds me about the whole, like, what did you say to the California Attorney General that Louisville is, what did you say? What was it that you got quoted as saying? You don't even want to repeat it, do you? Well, you're not ashamed of the quote. Oh, don't be ashamed.
We're tangenting as we're getting close to the end of the episode, unfortunately, because we run out of time. And so I guess where I was going with talking about some of the things we were talking about at the end, you know, we're two young people in about the same
age. We're not young anymore, but
You're right, we're not.
I'm an old millennial, and you're definitely an old.
No, right, you're right. I mean,
you're like an ancient millennial.
I feel a sense of urgency at age 36 because, again...
Well,
it's not just that. I feel like, you know, I have a limited window where I'm seeing the world as fresh as I used
to. This was a part of your campaign, I remember this.
Yeah,
right?
Like, I'm in favor of term limits.
I think you said something about, like, how being at this age, you're not yet, you know, have a full family, and you're sort of still,
Anyway, I guess my point was...
I totally butchered that, by the way.
For people our age.
Yes.
Who, you know, I want nothing more than folks our age to get more involved in government.
Uh-huh.
To get more involved in journalism, and you know, are you seeing that interest out there, or is there something that we're not doing right in terms of getting people in their 20s and 30s?
They're not involved in it in the way that you... I mean, you're a public official now. You're a square now, right? I mean, you're the man. You're the system. I mean, there are hundreds and thousands of young people involved in this community. I mean, Books and Breakfast, right? Sort of an offshoot of Stand Up, Hands Up United, which was a group founded out of Ferguson after the shooting of Michael Brown. They do monthly... So these community engagements where they have, you know, they read basically books and they talk about community engagement, politics, and there are young kids there. And if you're into that sort of thing, go out and see what they're about. I mean, those are a lot of people in their 20s who are involved in something like
you're
that.
You're totally right.
Right?
I guess all I'm saying is, you know, government is going to be part of the picture. It's like how our society is organized.
Yeah.
And so for all the people that do all this great work with their free time and with mm-hmm. their talents and they're involved in things... Do you think that there's still a disconnect from government because either government's not reaching out and doing a good enough job at the local level or that people just don't understand it?
I don't think government's the center. Like, the great thing about this country, this democracy, is that the government isn't the center of our universe.
That's a good point.
Right? I mean, like, and at the risk of sounding too libertarian, I mean, I think that politics is outside of government. Politics is, about, as Harold Laswell said, is about who gets what, where, and how. And that isn't always necessarily through government. There are plenty of young folks, I mean, through Black Lives Matter, through all sorts of different social justice campaigns on the right and the left, who are engaged. They might not be interested in running for public office right now or even see that as an option. They may be adverse to public office, but they're just as engaged as you and I are. They're doing their own media. They're doing their own podcasts. They're not just doing it in this very controlled format, which is why your podcast will get better when you loosen up.
And so
this is already good.
And so is... your newspaper covering those people with enough? Because again,
no.
You know, the way it's set up.
No, we're not.
You look in the newspaper every day, what are you writing about? You're writing about the government. You're
yes.
writing about, and so
yeah.
it sort of seems to people
and that, sort of retraction
that is the
from,
center of the universe.
Exactly, yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, can you personally or your newspaper or the industry or Louisville media, do we need to make a concerted, better effort to be telling those other stories?
Oh, yeah, no, just, no. One thing about journalism is that we always question what we're doing and have to always admit we need to do a better job. I mean, the one thing I love about this business is that, you know, look, every day someone tells me I'm wrong. It's called my editor. Mm-hmm. Every day someone is like, I don't like that. This is why is this way? Change this. I mean, if you have thin skin, don't do this job.
Or this job.
Yes, that's true. Unless you can sort of, you know, do briefings off camera and don't have to be accountable to the public as some public officials are not.
Again, clearly not a reference to me.
No, I wasn't mentioning you yet. You haven't not taken deliberately, at least not that I know of, my calls yet. But no, I mean, I think that, look, we can always do a better job of that. I know that I try to make a deliberate effort of trying to talk to, when I talk to residents at least, someone who hasn't been quoted previously, someone who hasn't been, you know, a frequent person in the news. I try to go out of my way to do that. But I can always do a better job. It may not seem like this on social media, but I never shy away from criticism. I will bite back at it if I think it's wrong, which I think most people are probably not used to. maybe at the risk of being charged with being uppity, which is a loaded term. But no, I mean, I think that there is, we can always do a better job of that, man. Always.
Right. In any event, so we do have to wrap up, but I really like this. I hope that people find it interesting, and we hope to have you on again. We do it once a month, so we'll have some more shows.
Thanks, Councilman.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to 8 More Miles, the Louisville Metro Council District 8 podcast. Please stay in touch with our office. Visit our website at www.tinyurl.com/cmconed8. And once you're there, please subscribe to receive our biweekly e-newsletter.